ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A new statue in Tehran depicting a Roman emperor bowing to a Persian king has just been unveiled. So what do you say? Well, erected in Tehran's central square, the statue, titled Kneeling Before Iran, shows the emperor grovelling, this is the Roman emperor, grovelling before Shapur I, who ruled about 242 to 270 CE. So why a new statue based on events nearly 1,800 years ago? And what does that say about the geopolitics of the region today? Gee, talk about ancient enmities here. Peter Edwall is Associate Professor in History and Archaeology at Macquarie University and Academic Curator of the Gale History Museum. Peter, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, Phil. Great to be on Nightlife.
Now, scholars apart, Peter, with all due respect, I suspect not many people these days would know the backstory of the Persian and Roman empires from this period. But tell us about these two empires facing off in the 4th century. What was it all about? What was going on?
Yeah, well, this is one of the great historical clashes that's going on at this time. And the Romans had been expanding out from their sort of Mediterranean European-based empire out into the areas known as Mesopotamia and Arabia and Syria. And so in the this is going on particularly in 1st century BC through to the 2nd century AD or CE. Mm-hmm. And then that's all at the expense of this quite powerful Iranian empire then known as the Parthians. But in the 3rd century, this new dynasty comes to power in the Iranian world, and they're known as the Sasanians. And they decide that they're going to challenge this Roman extension of power east. And the Romans had gotten all the way.
Because I was going to say, where had the Romans got to this stage? They never conquered Persia, did they?
They never conquered it, but they invaded it a few times. The Emperor Trajan in the early 2nd century got all the way to the Persian Gulf.
Oh, really?
And stood on the shores of the Persian Gulf. But by the end of the 2nd century and into the early 3rd century, they'd established provinces in what they called Mesopotamia, mm-hmm. which is actually on the upper Tigris River. So we're talking here southeastern Turkey, northeastern Syria, and northern Iraq. So it's a long way east. And this was territory that the Persians had always seen as really very much their own, and now the Romans are on the scene. Mm. And this new powerful dynasty decides that they've had enough of that, and from the 220s, 230s, they really start to very significantly challenge that Roman presence.
How do the Romans – that's a long line of logistics to maintain control and project power from
– Yes.
From the, I mean, even the Romans I know had an Eastern Empire, but even so – It's a long way to project power, isn't it?
It's a long way east, and it's territory that is becoming increasingly dissimilar, I suppose you'd say, to what the Romans were used to dealing with back in that sort of Mediterranean European world. So as they moved into these hotter, drier climates and areas, particularly when they were away from the rivers like the Euphrates and the Tigris, then they became more and more dependent on local elements that they drafted into the military to be able to hold on to that territory.
Okay, so this is the scene. So the Romans are pushing east, and the what are we calling them at the time? Are we calling them Persians or not?
Yeah, well, there's this sort of convention now. We're from the 220s. Once the Sasanian dynasty overthrows the old Parthian dynasty, then we refer to it as Sasanian Persia because the Sasanians are from the territory of Persis, or what we would call Persia, in modern southern Iran. So the Parthians had been more from up around the Caspian Sea, but with the Persians now in charge, then we tend to refer to this empire. And they controlled territory that's going from this area here in some parts of Mesopotamia and Armenia, up into the Caucasus areas south of Russia, down to Arabia, and then all the way over to Central Asia and parts of India. So they controlled this vast territory, the Parthians before them and now the Sasanians, and they become very much the great challengers to Roman imperial power further west.
This is pre-Islam, isn't it? So
yes.
The Romans, of course, are just beginning, are they, to deal with the influence of Christianity? Not really, probably, at this stage, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, the Christianity, it's becoming a more significant religion in the second and third centuries, but it's in the fourth century when the Emperor Constantine starts to really patronise and support it that then we see this almost in increasing Christianisation of the Roman Empire, yeah. But in the third century, the Sasanians are doing this with Zoroastrianism. So Zoroastrianism is a religion that they very much favour and they elevate to kind of has a national status by the end of the third century. So it's an interesting precursor to what we see with the Romans in the fourth century Christianity.
Well, it's continued on too, hasn't it? Zoroastrianism? Okay. All right. So who's the leader at the time? So this fellow Shapur the First, is it?
Shapur, he's the second of them. So he's the son of the founder of the Sasanian imperial dynasty, whose name was Ardashir. Uh-huh. And Shapur comes to power in the early 240s, and he's the one who really takes it up to the Romans. His father had done some of that, but Shapur is the one. Then there's actually a Roman invasion in the mid-240s, a pretty hapless one. Uh-huh. And that emperor, a young emperor called Gordian III, is killed in battle by Shapur on the lower Euphrates River. So they've made it into Persian territory by that stage. And his successor, whose name is Philip, has to do a deal with the Persians to get what's left of the army out of Persian territory. And then when we get into the 250s, Shapur really goes gangbusters and undertakes these invasions that take them all the way into modern southern Turkey. They capture dozens of cities. They take the very important city of Antioch, which at this stage is second, third most populated city in the Roman Empire, and they target captives, skilled captives in particular. So this is in the 250s, and then in 260, the great horror for the Romans is that the Emperor Valerian is captured alive, and this is the only time that an emperor's ever taken captive alive and then taken back off into enemy territory. There were emperors who'd been killed in battle, but here this is the only time we have an emperor who's taken captive and disappears back into Persian captivity.
So what's this statue all about? I mean, is it some sign of national manliness being displayed or something? Of what's going on?
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? What the Persians did, but Shapur did after he had these great victories over the Romans and after he took Valerian captive, he had celebrations of this put up around the empire and they put up rock reliefs. They had a number of rock reliefs carved that demonstrated Shapur in great glory, mounted on the back of a wonderfully decorated horse. Mm-hmm. And we have these emperors who'd been defeated and Valerian taken captive, all in subjection to him in the one rock relief. And so we have Gordian trampled underneath. We have Philip bowing before the horse and trying to beg for the army to be released, and Valerian being held captive, standing behind Shapur on the horse. And one of these reliefs from a place called Naqshi Rustam, again in southern Iran, doesn't have Gordian. It only has Philip on bended knee and then Valerian behind him. And what this new statue is a statue of Shapur on the horse, and it's modelled very much on this rock relief from Naqshi Rustam and this bowing, scraping emperor before the horse, but it doesn't have the figure behind. So what the current regime is doing is it's really trying to reach back into that pre-Islamic past to demonstrate the great strength of Iranian leadership in the past, times where the Iranian Empire very much had a Western Empire like the Romans on the back foot and in subjection to it. And given recent developments and recent events, particularly the bombings of Iranian nuclear facilities back in June, this seems to be now a new tack that the regime is taking to demonstrate.
Oh, I see. So they're saying they're saying what we've triumphed over the West before. Historically, is this it?
Absolutely.
Historically, we humiliated the West once and we could maybe do it again.
We could maybe do it again. And what's really interesting is that the regime here, this is really one of the first times that the regime is reaching back into the pre-Islamic past to demonstrate. Yeah. So they've sort of tended to ignore the pre-Islamic past since 1979. And this is actually something that's coming out a little bit from the Iranian population itself. Now this is an appeal to this sort of great past and linking back to that, And it's all ultimately, some of it is internal messaging. In fact, I think in this case, it's mostly about internal messaging, given that the regime is shakier now after what, particularly what happened back in June. But it also, of course, is aimed at a Western audience. And so it's quite a powerful image when you think about it.
Yes, because, I mean, well, I presume, that's right, because the Persians were following the collapse of the Roman Empire, you know, through the years after Constantine and so on. The Persian Empire actually grew more powerful, didn't it?
Well, the Persians, they continue on to the middle of the 7th century, and the Romans do, of course, in the east, after the collapse of the Roman Empire in the west in the 5th century, the Romans continue on in the east, essentially all the way up to 1453, with what we call the Byzantine Empire. But the Sasanians, they're very powerful rivals of the Romans for centuries after this period we're talking about. So by the end of the 3rd century, it sort of balances up. So the Romans have a great victory over the then Persian king at the end of the 3rd century, and there's kind of now sort of much more in balance in terms of the power between the two. The 4th century does see some very significant Sasanian victories in the middle of the 4th century, but they kind of settle down to this sort of almost grudging rivalry, and they admit really to each other that they're here to stay. You know, they know that they're... In fact, we have this reference in one really interesting text of an embassy at the end of the 3rd century from the Persians to the Romans, where the Persian ambassador refers to the Sasanian Empire and the Roman Empire as the two eyes of the earth. The two eyes of the earth. This is how they view it, that we're essentially we share power over the whole earth between us.
Well, Peter Edwards, professor in history, associate professor in history and archaeology at Macquarie University, and we're talking about a new statue in Tehran depicting a Roman emperor bowing to a Persian king. It's just been unveiled, and it seems to be an exercise in trying to place Iranian prestige all the way back to way back then, to the 2nd century, when the Persians did humiliate the Romans for a period of time. We reported as an incident of mistaken identity in our history realms in Australia when some Queensland schools learnt about the wrong Caesar for their end of year 12 exams, Peter. Embarrassing, I know.
Yes, but, terrible, wasn't it? Those poor kids. Oh, I feel so sorry for them. Yeah.
But how historically accurate is this statue? Is it actually the Roman emperor that they say it is?
Yeah, well, this is where there's a bit of a problem, Phil, because if it's modelled, and it's certainly very much when you look at the iconography of this statue and compare it with the Naqshbandi Rustam rock relief, it's modelled clearly on that, and there's a really good reason why it would be modelled on that. But the emperor that is shown here in the new statue, so we've got the statue bowing and scraping before the king.
The mighty Shapur, yes.
Yeah, is traditionally interpreted as Philip rather than Valerian. So they're sort of saying in the news releases that this is Valerian before Shapur, but actually the way these reliefs have been interpreted for a long time is that the one bowing is actually Philip. He's sort of begging, as it were, really. He's more the pose. And he's the one who's begging for the release of the Roman army after the death of that Emperor Gordian I was talking about before. Right. And Valerian is actually shown that held behind Shapur, standing behind the horse and held by the right hand. So, look, they're calling it Valerian. The scholarly interpretation is that this figure is Philip. is it that big a deal? I mean, I don't think the regime would be, you know, hugely concerned about that. But, I mean, yeah, you raise this issue of the problems in the Queensland HSC with the students studying Augustus instead
Caesar, yes.
Yeah. I mean... It can't be excused. There is an explanation for that, but it's in that up to last year they had been studying Augustus, and the switch came this time to Julius Caesar. So, a number of schools were caught out on
So, anyway, interesting. So, how the. The quest for legitimacy and legitimising one's regime can reach back into ancient times. Peter, interesting to talk. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, no, terrific, Phil. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.